This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Catherine Fritke, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of September 11th, here are a few top stories. In the news, it's all about Arizona politics today. Here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
The state Republican Party has a new state director. Alex Melendez is a joint hire with the Arizona GOP and Republican National Committee and has worked for a number of candidates, including Mitt Romney and Rick Scott. With me to talk about the new hire and other issues is Jonathan Lyons, chairman of the Arizona Republican Party. And Chairman Lyons, to you, what's the importance of this hire?
We had kind of an ambitious goal to register new volunteers and register new Republicans this year, and that was the plan that I submitted and interviewed several people. Alex brings a pretty diverse background as far as working in different campaigns all over the nation, almost in every region, and you know, has got a good experience as far as organizing a ground game, and that's why we settled on him and jointly hired him with the RNC.
So how does that work then between his work with you and the RNC? I mean, you call it a joint hire. What exactly does that mean?
That means that we're working together with a victory plan for 2018. We map out the state. We have some objectives as far as registrations in every area. And then he meets with me two or three times a week, and we see where we're at and where we need to move people around and continue to evolve that effort and initiative of reaching out to people and sharing our messaging.
At this stage in the game, what do you see as the challenges and the opportunities for the state Republican Party looking ahead to 2018?
We've got several races that are critical to us. Retaining our Senate seat is very important. And, you know, we've got a couple of people in the race right now. Arizona GOP won't take sides in a primary, in a contested primary, but we'll continue to strengthen the base so that they can turn out and support the candidate that they deem best to represent Arizona. And we feel like we have a real opportunity to take back CD1 with Tom O'Halloran, and we've got a couple of good candidates there. And then we'll defend Martha McSally's seat. That was our first political director hire for that region. And really, you know, focusing on registrations and then sharing our messaging.
I want to ask you about the Senate race with Senator Flake, because as you say, the AZGOP traditionally, and this time as well, will not take sides in a primary. That has not really been the case with the leader of the national GOP, President Trump, who has really not been all that kind to Mr. Flake. Are you concerned about how that might play out, at least in the primary?
Well, it's a long way till the primary, and I think that the president's tweet kind of speaks for itself, and we will continue to stay neutral. When I was in the Oval Office a little over a month and a half ago, we had that conversation, and that was my commitment, that the party would continue to remain neutral, and we will focus on, you know, doing what we do best, and that's registering new people and looking for volunteers.
Would you prefer that the president not send tweets like that or make comments like the ones he made when he was in town about Senator Flake and, to an extent, Senator McCain?
I have an extremely difficult job to remain, you know, neutral. We have a very diverse group of Republicans, and I can't speak on behalf of any of them. I know that I can, you know, focus on what my job is. It's sometimes controversial, but I wouldn't pretend to speak for any one of them.
But I would imagine that to some extent that doesn't make your job easier. I mean, as you say, you have a difficult job when there is sort of this infighting or name-calling or whatever you want to call it amongst different members of the party. I can't imagine that makes your job any easier.
No, it's not easy, but I mean, that's what we signed up for, and we remind everybody that we're here to strengthen the base and to give the grassroots the tools that they need, the data, so that they can go out and continue to build the party. If people want to make a lasting change, it's made by recruiting people so that they can get the candidate that they feel best about across the finish line.
In addition to the races that you've mentioned, there are obviously all the statewide races, governor, AG, treasurer, superintendent, secretary of state, all those races. Are you feeling fairly confident about the GOP's chances in those races as well?
We have great people who are in office now. We have great candidates that are stepping up. I know it'll be drawn out in a protracted, you know, primary, and look forward to those debates. But I feel confident with the team that we have in place right now that we'll be able to get them across the finish line.
Given the number of races that are happening this year, all the statewide races, legislative races, we have a U.S. Senate race, are you confident that your state party will have the resources it needs to either defend the seats you need to defend or try to go on offense in the seats you're trying to win?
We have initiated a ground game earlier than any other state and earlier than Arizona ever has. And we've got all of our hires in place. We're opening up offices all around the state. Our fundraising is at a record pace, and we have people who are committed to the party. We've got lots of new people who are stepping up to participate, some emboldened by our current elected officials on both sides. But I look forward to continuing to raise money at a record pace and continue to put people into place so that we can protect the seats that we've got and then go after new seats as well.
That's Jonathan Lyons, the chairman of the State Republican Party. Chairman Lyons, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much, Mark.
In the world of business, there's a skilled labor shortage in Arizona, but new development isn't slowing down. From KJZZ's East Valley Bureau, Jimmy Jenkins reports contractors are turning to prefabricated designs as the commercial construction industry evolves.
There's another hotel sprouting up in downtown Phoenix. As the urban core fills in, construction crews have less room to work. It's just one of the reasons many contractors are turning to prefabricated construction. A semi stacked with pre-made wall panels enters the site at First and Polk Streets.
It's all panelized exterior, panelized interior, all the way through finishes on the exterior and drywall one side on the interior.
Zeke Delgadillo is the project engineer for the site. We watch as a giant crane lifts the panels up to what will become the 11th floor of a Hampton Inn. The prefab walls all have a designated place so workers can put them up quickly and efficiently.
From start to finish and install for a sequence of a floor, we're looking at 15 days. It definitely is a time saver.
Inside on the 11th floor, two workers hoist up a prefab wall and slide it into place. All the components, wall sockets, wiring, plumbing, are already in the wall. On the lower floors, where more intricate, specialized work is needed, you'll still find masons, electricians, and plumbers. But here on the upper floors, where all the rooms are the same, there's no tradesmen at all.
Yeah, I mean, unions never like to see skilled jobs go away, but you have to embrace change sometimes.
Dean Wine is the Arizona Building Trades president. He says low wages in Arizona have decimated the skilled labor force.
We have a lot of members who go to California, and they're making $70 an hour plus in California for electricians. So when we're paying, you know, $27, people leave.
He says trade unions are adapting to the changing landscape by adding new classifications for workers with less experience.
If you're not an apprentice or a journeyman, we still have a place for people who have mid-range of experience to come and do the prefab work and kind of learn stuff about the trade as they move up in it.
At a warehouse in Tempe, workers on an assembly line are sanding and smoothing a wall panel, causing white insulation dust to cover them like snow. Scott Root is the managing executive of the Capture Group, the company making the prefabbed walls for the Hampton Inn.
So we have 32,000 square feet in the shop. It's set up in the assembly line manner so that the material comes in, gets staged, and then goes to each of the stations.
Workers assembling the walls follow instructions that look a lot like what you'd get with your IKEA bookcase. The plans are printed on a simple 11 by 17 inch sheet, color-coded to make assembly easier for less skilled workers. It takes about 4 days for a panel to get all the way down the line, and it's ready to be shipped to the construction site. Root says eventually he wants to expand from just building panels
to be building large modules of buildings in a shop and delivering those to a job site, and then that's where assembling as a Lego block will really, really add benefit to the clients.
Back in downtown Phoenix, Chase Gibbs is keeping an eye on the Hampton Inn site. He's a project manager for Mortenson, the contractor for the job.
Most of our owners always want things quicker and cheaper. And in order to do that, you have to find better ways of building it.
He says prefab construction allowed them to shave about 2 weeks off the project, which is huge for a property like a hotel.
The quicker you open to the public, the quicker you're going to gain revenue and the less overhead you're going to have to build it, of course.
He says they're on schedule to have all 11 floors and 210 rooms built by May of 2018. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And now, here's a segment from KJZZ's original production, The Show.
An anti-fascist movement has been gaining traction in the U.S., called Antifa for short. The group is known for its militant style and tactics. The activists have shown up at far-right rallies to counter-protest, toting semi-automatic weapons. They were in Charlottesville and most recently in Portland, where violence erupted yesterday between Antifa supporters and far-right demonstrators, as well as police officers. Josh Meyer is a senior investigative reporter for Politico. He's been writing about Antifa and its role in protests like in Charlottesville and others. His latest article out today is about how extremist groups, including Antifa, are exploiting loose gun control laws by showing up at rallies with assault rifles and other weapons. I spoke with Josh about the movement, starting with its spike in notoriety over the past few weeks.
Well, I think to me, Mark, what was newsworthy about this is that they have been getting some notoriety among the general public, but that they've gotten a lot more notoriety by the federal law enforcement community. They've been watching these guys, or men and women, for more than a year now, and growing increasingly concerned that they're getting more militant, that they're getting more training and operational planning and coordination, and that they pose a very serious threat.
How significant is it that the Homeland Security Department has classified their activities as domestic terrorist violence? Like, what does that mean, and how significant is it?
It's significant in that the Department of Homeland Security and other federal law enforcement officials, the FBI, once they start using that term, you know, it suggests, or more than suggests, confirms that they're taking them very seriously. They're very concerned about their ability to get weapons and use them, everything from homemade shields and clubs and things like that to, you know, semi-automatic weapons and things of that nature. You know, some of the earlier law enforcement sensitive documents that I have referred to them just as domestic extremists. And then you would see the terminology of domestic terrorism starting to sort of filter into the documentation as the law enforcement people would circulate it among themselves. So they're taking it very seriously.
Yeah, do you get the sense that, given this new classification, that law enforcement might take greater notice if they get intelligence that members of this group might be at a particular event in their communities?
I think so, yeah. And it's important to note that some of these right-wing groups, too, have shown up in law enforcement. They're called intelligence analysis documents. You know, some of the right-wing groups have shown up in those as well, but it's new that these Antifa people have, I think. And yeah, I think it's certainly a flag for law enforcement at the state, local, and federal level to take them very seriously. You know, of course, not everybody affiliated with any of these groups is by nature a domestic terrorist. And in fact, there is no, you know, criminal statute or designation for a domestic terrorist. So it's more of a sort of a nomenclature than anything else.
What is the organizational structure of Antifa?
You know, that's something that I don't think the authorities are even, they don't really have a good handle on it. I thought that was one of the most important things to come out of the reporting, was that they've acknowledged that they really don't know enough about these groups. And, you know, partly it's because they've really come to the fore over the last year after President Trump was elected. But even during the campaign, they were there. But they date back many, many years. I mean, a lot of these people, the Antifa people, came out of the Occupy movement. They came out of the people protesting the G20 summit. So they should have a good handle on who these people are. But what they do say is that they're very, very decentralized. It's almost like a leaderless, movement. But there are clearly people that are helping coordinate this, helping move from city to city. I'm told that there are leaders, you know, that do go from one event to another.
We keep hearing that members of Antifa are anti-fascist, but I'm wondering if you can sort of give us a better sense of what exactly members of this group stand for.
You know, I think that these Antifa people think of themselves as sort of the modern-day equivalent of the old-fashioned anti-fascist fighters in the United States, in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, in places like that, where they were really fighting, you know, the rise of Hitler and Mussolini and real, you know, dictators like that. And, you know, what they like to say is that if we don't fight back now with violence where needed, bad people will do bad things. And we're sort of the firewall protecting good people from evil. So, you know, I think that they, at least many of them, have good intentions, but you know, the law enforcement in particular are very concerned that they're using the wrong tactics and that one of these days somebody's going to get killed.
Does it seem like members of Antifa use the events in which they are involved? Do they try to get that out on social media as a recruitment tool or as a way to bring more people to future events and try to either outmaneuver or overwhelm law enforcement or members of other groups that they're fighting against?
They do. I mean, we noted in the stories that, or I noted in the stories, you know, that both sides are using the rallies and the public confrontations to their own benefit. I mean, there's sort of a vicious cycle where they go to a rally, violence ensues, and then they take to social media and go online and not only, you know, threaten the other side and say that, you know, the next time I see you, it's going to be worse, but they use it as a recruiting tool to raise money. And, you know, that's just escalating the violence on both sides to the point where, you know, authorities are very, very nervous that, you know, one of these times they're going to show up at a rally together and something really bad is going to happen. One of the things that they're concerned about is what's called a reflex shooting, in which, you know, there's a crowd full of people with guns, and especially if they have their guns trained on each other, which hasn't happened yet. But, you know, if one person fires reflexively, anybody else who has their finger on a trigger pulls it. It's a human, you know, reflex action that you really can't even override. And, you know, police trained for years, you know, to override that, you know, and they're concerned that if you're in a group like this with a bunch of amateurs or people that don't have a lot of training, that, you know, if somebody accidentally pulls a trigger, for instance, or shoots out of fear for their safety, that you're going to have a whole bunch of people starting to open fire.
Josh Meyer is a senior investigative reporter for Politico in Washington. Josh, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
From our science desk, the tools needed for building the future aren't listed in a catalog. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbus reports on how the arts and sciences must sometimes walk hand in lab glove to invent them.
Don't get too close. So this is...
Orange fire is reflected in Christine Rager's dark eyewear as she turns a glass tube in her blowtorch's flame. Her hands move in concert as she waits for a honey-like consistency, showing it's ready to be blown, twisted, or pinched.
I'm heating the glass up right now, and I'm just going to kind of stretch out a handle here for me to be able to rotate.
Go to any major research university, and you'll find the most advanced science relies on an art older than alchemy.
You have to be pretty patient to be a glass blower. You have to wait for it to cool the right amount. You can't rush anything.
Rager is a third-generation scientific glassblower. She took over Arizona State University's glass shop 12 years ago from her dad, who taught her the trade.
In between classes, I'd come in here and visit my dad and hang out in a nice, cool spot and kind of just started working with him a little bit.
Today, she serves 4 campuses of research faculty and graduate students all by herself.
Sometimes they come in not knowing what they need. Sometimes they come in knowing exactly what they need, and I can help guide them.
Rager also teaches grad students the basics of her craft.
The name that they give that class is Burn and Bleed 101.
David Wright is a material scientist at ASU. Because his work involves extremes of temperature, pressure, and reactivity, he relies heavily on quartz glass.
It's really an amazing material. Couldn't live without it.
Quartz glass is a bit of a misnomer. Quartz, by definition, is crystalline silica. It's orderly. Glasses are the opposite of orderly, more like frozen chaos. ASU chemist Jeff Yarger says that just about any liquid can become a glass if you cool it fast enough.
It will be a frozen liquid. It will have complete disorder, like liquids do, but the motion will be froze out of it, so it'll be a solid that is the structure or have the disorder of a liquid. That's a glass.
Yarger mainly works with borosilicate glass. This mix of silica and boron oxide, better known as Pyrex, is malleable at a lower temperature. Both glasses are known for their non-reactivity and ability to stand up to thermal shock.
You can pull it off the flame and put it into, you know, liquid nitrogen, and it can handle these huge temperature fluctuations.
For standard work, chemists and engineers can order standard parts.
Even when you buy something from one of the glass companies and it's a prefabricated apparatus, you almost always want it to be modified to do what you're going to do with it.
But out-of-the-box thinking can't rely on off-the-shelf glass.
Oftentimes what makes the ability to do new things is also the apparatus, not just the chemicals.
Take Thomas Dempster, lab manager of ASU's Center for Algae Technology and Innovation. To cultivate his research subjects, he needed something quite basic, but surprisingly elusive.
We needed intermediate sizes of cultivation vessels or large glass culture tubes that just weren't available on the market anywhere. And to the best of my knowledge, they're still not available.
Beyond customization and innovation, in-house glassblowers save their schools time and money.
Laboratory glassware is extremely expensive, and we drop stuff from time to time.
Dempster says the glass shop charges 1/10 to 1/20 of what companies would, with a much faster turnaround. Nevertheless, scientific glassblowing is a dying art.
It's slowly been dwindling. It seems like lately if people retire, they shut down the shop and kind of start outsourcing. But us glassblowers are trying to change that.
Rager is working to reestablish the apprenticeship program that taught her. For now, she's glad to see more women entering a historically male-dominated field.
I remember going to my first meeting as the glassblower, and everybody was kind of like, well, where does your husband work?
As for whether there'll be a fourth generation, Rager says she'd love it if one of her two sons would like to take up the torch. No pressure. Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Board of Regents has decided to charge DACA recipients in-state tuition, pending a decision by the state Supreme Court. Now, the state attorney general is suing the governing body that oversees Arizona's three public universities. From the Fronteras desk in Phoenix, KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports the suit came just before a deadline from the state's biggest hawk on immigration, Russell Pierce.
In July, the conservative group Judicial Watch sent a letter to Attorney General Mark Brnovich on Pierce's behalf. It promised that if Brnovich did not sue the Board of Regents over its decision to charge DACA students in-state tuition, Pierce would. Now Brnovich is suing the Regents, but he says the case sprang from a broader question, whether the Regents have followed the state constitutional mandate to make college as free as possible.
We don't do our job based on threats or whatever some third party may or may not do. We do at this office what the law requires us to do.
The lawsuit alleges the Board of Regents' tuition setting policy is unconstitutional. It also says the Regents risk the state's ability to charge out-of-state students higher rates by giving DACA students in-state tuition. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from our Fronteras desk, the Hualapai tribe has agreed to end a decades-long conflict over Colorado River water rights in exchange for a $130 million pipeline that will supply water to the tribe's Grand Canyon tourist attractions. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
About 1 million people visit Grand Canyon West each year to step out on the glass skywalk over the natural wonder. Hualapai Chairman Damon Clark spoke before the Senate Indian Affairs Committee last year and says the attraction employs 300 tribal members and 300 non-natives. Most drive 2 hours to work each day to live near a water source.
We're proud of the fact that the tribe is moving forward towards achieving full employment for our members and economic self-sufficiency, but the severe lack of water on the reservation is a major obstacle in reaching these goals.
Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake have introduced legislation that would give the Hualapai 4,000 acre-feet of Colorado River water each year, while securing enough water for the rest of the state. About 40% of Arizona relies on the Colorado River as its water source. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Arizona Community Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Alliance Bank of Arizona, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Catherine Fritke, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.